Okay, Robert, thank you for taking that over. Now I'd like to introduce tonight's speaker, which is Pat R. Take it away, Pat R.
Hey everybody, I'm Pat, a grateful member of Al-Anon. Good to see all the familiar faces and some new faces. Are you sure we don't have any more announcements? It's got to be more. Something. Come on. Okay.
I would sure like to have a speaker and leader for Saturday night.
All right. Maybe we can get to that.
All right. Appreciate it.
Thanks. So, wow. So I have actually waited for this moment for many years. I've been a member of the men's group 7 o'clock Let's Rock for over 24 years. Take that back, 20 years, been in Al-Anon 24. And we used to meet in that small room, I think it was Harris Hall, where there was about 30 of us. And I remember, you know, a lot of you guys at my humble beginnings. And remember Randall. I remember giving Randall a nickname at one of those meetings. And that was pretty good. But yeah, it wasn't planned, of course, but sometimes there's happy accidents, so, and long-lasting friendships. So, I just want to say, thank you, Johnny, for asking me to do this. Pretty cool to have this privilege. And and I understand that the bar that I need to reach, it's a little high, but as long as I don't burst into flames, I think it is, then I pass. So we'll see how it goes. If you're new, please keep an open mind. There might be something I say that that rings a bell with you, that resonates. And if not, please keep coming back, try different meetings, and hopefully find one that works for you. If not, we will gladly refund your misery. So, and this, I have to say, it's a little strange not hearing any feedback, but I'm gonna go with it. Okay, so, So my life has been affected by alcoholism for sure, severely affected by alcoholism. And it's permeated every area of my life. And all I have to say is thank God that there's a place I get to come to meet with my family, my new family of choice, and to be able to see my value for the first time, and to know that although sometimes I guess in life we're met with different situations that bring us here. We either marry into alcoholism, alcoholic spouse, maybe it's a brother, sister, parent, child. And for me, the drinker was my dad. And it wasn't so much the drinking that bothered me as it was the behavior as a result of the drinking, if that makes sense to you. He was a mechanic by trade, worked a graveyard shift, loved to fish, and he was also a gambler and love the ponies, love Vegas, and he kept a roof over our heads. It was me, my dad, my mom, and my brother, who's older by 2 years. And so he was not only a drinker, but he was a rager, and was, I'm going to say unknowingly, quite a bit neglectful of his kids when they were younger, because he was so wrapped up in his projects and the stress of his life. I just remember, you know, if he wasn't working on something, fixing something, remodeling the house, working on the cars, fixing the washing machine, he fixed everything. He was kind of a jack of all trades type of guy. And but he had this pattern of starting a project and not finishing it. And so he was good at fixing things, but a lot of times he would leave stuff undone, unfinished. And so our house kind of looked like this collection of unfinished projects. And he was a little menacing to me, especially as a little kid. I remember one day he came home from fishing, and he had a fishing hook stuck in his finger. And he passed out on the couch. And I remember sneaking over to go look at the hook in his finger. And that may have been as close as I ever got to my dad when I was younger. And not only did I notice the hook in his finger, but I got to see his tattoos. And interesting. So that was Dad. My mom, she was, I hate to say, the untreated Al-Anon. I haven't come up with a better description than that, but that kind of wraps it up in a nutshell. And she was kind of the martyr, the mother, the manager type of thing. She was really good at shuttling me and my brother around to our baseball games. And she was the team mom, the scorekeeper, the den mother, you name it. She was really, really involved. And that's why it's not so easy. Sometimes it's confusing to others, including myself, when I talk about feeling like I didn't have that support. I think that she was, as we say, a human doing rather than a human being. And so I'm going to say that, she could be emotionally unavailable to a certain degree. But man, she did everything for me and my brother. I guess you can say we were spoiled. Feel like I'm jumping around here, but it was tough setting boundaries, and I let me talk about my brother a little bit, and then I'll back up. So then there's my brother, 2 years older, a lot of sibling rivalry. I think looking back, I believe what was going on is my brother was kind of filling the gap that was there as a result of my dad's drinking. So my dad kind of being checked out, my brother sort of tried to fill those shoes. And I just didn't like being told what to do by my brother. So we would get into it as kids. There was also some bullying type of behavior. I remember my brother getting bullied in school. Remember him coming home being scared to death that some older kid was going to beat him up because he accidentally broke his radio on the basketball court. The ball hit his transistor radio, AM, FM. And it was just interesting how that I saw that trickle down towards me. And so I caught the brunt end of that. And, but as far as my dad's rage, that was directed towards my mom when we were younger, as my brother, approached, 18 years old, it started to be directed towards him. And later when he left the nest, when he found a way out, I found that that rage got directed towards me. And it happened about the same time, about 18 years old. And I can see today, you know, that was the, that was my dad's fear. You know, that was his, the self-hatred, the projection, and needing a scapegoat type of thing. Because I just remember a lot of blame and taking on, a lot of blame, and kind of learning at that point in my life how to be a doormat, I believe. The message I would get from my mom was, you know, she didn't want to see me stand up to my dad, and didn't want me to rock the boat. Don't upset your father. And so that's kind of what I complied with. And gosh, so I want to put this focus back on me. So that's my family of origin. That's my perception, my experience. And I want everyone to know that, that my parents, my brother, my mom, my dad, everybody did the best they could with what they knew. And I used to hate when people would say that. It felt like such a cop out, but, today that burden is lifted. And I do believe that, there is, I will say forgiveness there, even though think, words on forgiveness can be, Al-Anon has a point of view on that. And so anyways, I'm going to talk a little bit about just a little bit more about family of origin. So I basically grew up without a whole lot of limits. Found myself spending a large amount of times hanging out outside, roaming the neighborhood, that type of thing. And I had a couple of traumatic events that I recall. And I'm just going to mention them because they, there seemed to be sort of a pattern there. I just thought it was interesting, but one was, I was a very young child, and, I had walked down the street. All the neighborhood kids were, across the street, and, there was one of the older neighborhood, teenagers, I guess. He would grab the kids and throw them in the trunk of his car and lock the trunk, and it scared me to death. So I found myself running home. That's my memory, running home, frantic, and there was kind of a blackout there. And next thing I remember, my mom giving me a spoonful of sugar, and so I can't prove it, but I think that's where my sugar addiction comes from. and so what was interesting about that is, I saw that little trauma kind of play out and sort of repeat itself. We had this camper, this old camper parked in our driveway, and, it had these horizontal drawers up on the overcab next to the bed. And, I was with a friend. And I decided it would be a good idea to climb inside the thing, and told my friend, okay, when I tell you, go ahead and let me out. And So anyways, when I was, I guess, ready to get out, he didn't know how to unlock it. It had a kind of a locking, you had to pull up on the handle type of thing. And so, thank God he had enough sense to go grab my mom. And, I don't know how long I was in there, but, anyways, two events that, sort of tie into my, my life, as I would progress. So, I'm going to jump ahead to, fifth grade. So fifth grade is significant, because I found myself, getting in trouble every day with the teacher. I was basically trying to be the class clown type of thing, and, found myself, making jokes at the teacher's expense, which is not very smart. And, I would get sent to the principal's office, and I just remember they had this stack of referrals in this drawer, and they would bring my mom in and ask her, is everything okay at home? And my mom would say, yes, everything's fine. And I think that was just that Al-Anon, untreated Al-Anon type of response, you know, where we, I guess, everything is supposed to look good on the outside, but it's really painful and falling apart on the inside. And so, I just thought it was interesting that, I was in an adjacent room, and I heard the conversation, and remember that, so anyways, negative attention is better than no attention. That's what I came up with that. Negative attention is better than no attention. And I just got another piece of the puzzle recently. I've been doing some, getting some outside help as well, and which I highly recommend if you're contemplating that. Yeah, it's been really helpful for me. So, I recently discovered that all the times that my brother was picking on me when we were kids, and I would call my mom crying, and she'd be at work, and we were latchkey kids, and so we'd be at home, you know, nobody supervising us, and I'd call crying that he did whatever. Something, and he knew how to get a rise out of me, I guess, and so recently realized that he was seeking negative attention just like I was, and it's just interesting to put that together. So I went through life bringing my family with me into every situation, into every relationship, into every job, every friendship. I brought my family with me, and I projected them onto you. And I would throw some bait out there to see if you would take it. And if you took it, then I got to say, you know, see, I knew you're just like the rest. You're just like them. I didn't know I was doing this. It wasn't conscious, but that's exactly what I was doing. Kind of jumping around, but I'm going to kind of continue with this. So kind of moving forward to high school, I was a bit of an adrenaline junkie. And that's, I guess, how I kind of got release and got out of my head a little bit. I was also a narcissist, very narcissistic. And I wasn't the kind of narcissist that thinks he's the best, he's the greatest, and everybody knows it. I was the narcissist that thought I was a piece of shit, that I was worthless, and everybody knew it. Or I fought my hardest to not be exposed. So I went through a series of crash and burn type of relationships, and I would, you know, pursue a girl, we start dating, and I would just fall hard, and then I would usually be the one ending up getting hurt. Person would bail, and so never thought to consider the women I was choosing. I was just thought it was, you know, it was them. They were the ones with the, they were at fault. I also recall, thinking that anger was a bad emotion, and that, my dad was an angry person. I didn't ever want to feel this emotion. And so I wasn't going to feel it. And so basically I did my best to stuff down those feelings. And, you know, that is not healthy. That is not a healthy thing. But that was my thinking at the time. And so I basically went through life full of resentment, self-pity, fear, fear. And the one thing I knew for sure was despair, because I went to bed with that every night and woke up with that every morning, and didn't quite know what that was, why that was. It was just there. And so kind of had the weight of the world on my shoulders. And I kept kind of, I guess, upping the ante. I found myself getting straight A's in college. I ended up just aiming high, setting these very lofty goals for myself, and I would reach each goal, and thinking that once I got there, you know, then everything would be okay, and it wasn't. I can never quite hold on to the confidence, and it was always fleeting, and my self-worth was just, you know, at less than zero. So I'm getting these straight A's. I find out about, I have an interest in attending film school. So I applied to two schools that interested me. One was UCLA, one was Art Center. UCLA accepted me into their College of Letters and Science, but they said, go ahead and apply again in a year and we'll consider you for film school. And Art Center accepted me right away. So I said, I'm going to Art Center, because I want to shoot film. That's what I want to do. So I found myself in film school, and about the time I would find the rooms of Al-Anon, but just really got to see this disease play out. And I want to say the incident that kind of brought me in was, I drove this Volkswagen Bug, this old 1968 rust bucket. It was like three colors of primer, and it had shiny chrome bumpers and clean windows, but kind of a banged up car. And it was a great little car, got me where I needed to go. But I'll tell you, that car, the outsides of that car matched my insides. That's exactly how I felt. And just kind of carried the shame with me. And I think driving that car was probably maybe even a way to keep people at a distance, which I did in other ways as well. In our brother program in Alcoholics Anonymous, they have promises. And one of those promises is fear of people and economic insecurity will leave us. And I certainly had that. I had fear of people and economic insecurity for sure. And it wasn't just because I was a broke student going to a very expensive school. It was built into the disease. So just to back up a little bit, I mentioned my dad is a mechanic. He taught me a little bit about working on my car. I'm not sure if this was a trust issue or a perfectionism issue or what, but I found myself needing to be the one that worked on my car. And my dad at first would try to help me, but I got tired of the him kind of he would start to drink and rage, and he would pull, you know, kind of take the wrench from me and say, here, let me do that, you're gonna mess it up, type of thing. And I just thought, okay, I'm just gonna do this on my own. So anyways, he didn't like that very much when I sort of set a boundary. So that car was, it was a joy to drive when it was working well, when it was running well, but when it wasn't, it was kind of like a codependent relationship. You know, if it was running great, I felt great. If it wasn't, I felt bad. And so one day I needed a ride to school. It was about 30 minutes to get to school. And so my dad agreed to give me a ride. And I'm just like thinking of how impressed he's going to be. You know, he'd never been to my campus. So it's up there by the Rose Bowl, up in the hills, and pretty nice campus, very kind of artsy place, design oriented. And as you turn the corner, you see this spanning, it's kind of a spanning bridge across a ravine. And it's all one building. So as we turned that corner, my dad said, don't ever ask me for a ride up here again. And that was tough. So anyways, that was about, I think, the time that I made a call. And I want to say I called central office. I think I actually called 411, if you guys remember 411. So they probably gave me the central office. My Eskimo was... one of my managers. I worked for this this five-star gourmet steak restaurant in Alhambra. It was Sizzler. You probably heard of it. So I had this one manager tell me one day, hey, have you heard of Al-Anon? And I don't remember what I was saying, but I can only imagine I was going on and on about my dad. And And so I really reached a point where I could not go on as I had before. I felt beaten down, just the weight of the world on my shoulders. I made it into my first meeting, which was at Las Encinas Hospital in Pasadena. And I remember being greeted at the door and by a man named Jerry, and it just scared the hell out of me. He had a smile from ear to ear and kind of, you know, gave me the welcome. And it was kind of like, whoa, hang on a second. It was actually the first time I saw myself in that moment that I didn't trust people. And I didn't know that about myself. And so I started attending Al-Anon. It was on a Thursday night, and I couldn't wait for that meeting to come around. Couldn't wait for Thursday night every week, because I didn't realize there were Al-Anon meetings on every day of the week. And so I would just look so forward to that day. And to thank God for that meeting and the people in that room who helped to love me until I could love myself. And it was just the beginning, but I had this one gal, her name was Bobby, and she would sit next to me. And when it was time to share, she would raise my arm up. And so I would share. And by her doing that, what she taught me was that even though I was afraid, it was okay to walk through that. And that there was actually a reward waiting for me on the other side of that fear. And I gained 10 times the recovery in that meeting by sharing than had I not. So I learned that was a very powerful tool to share. I saw these steps and traditions on the wall. The traditions didn't interest me a whole lot, but I remember seeing this step about owing people an amends. And I thought to myself, I don't owe them an amends. They owe me an amends. So if you think that people owe you an amends, it's possible you have a resentment. And so it was a slow process. I kept coming back because I felt better after the meeting than before I got there. There was something happening, something working inside me that I had never experienced before. And I knew that my life depended on it. No one needed to tell me that. I know some people get to the rooms and they're not sure if they belong. And for me, there was no question. I wasn't there to get the alcoholic sober. Wasn't there to get my dad to stop drinking. I was there because I was miserable. And I was asking for help and I was accepting help. So I want to kind of share this. How am I doing on time? Can I ask? Good. Thank you, Johnny.
It's almost 8 o'clock.
Okay. And I go until what time?
You can go to 8:25. You've got 25 more minutes if you want.
Copy that. Thank you. All right, so I gotta say, like, Al-Anon gave me the sense of community that I was missing, because I was completely isolated when I was studying in college. I would lock myself in the room and just focus on the books, and gave me a sense of belonging. I took service positions early on because I saw that's what other people were doing. I wasn't very good at making the coffee. I really liked the literature commitment because I could peek at the literature at home or between meetings. So I wanted to talk about when I was in film school. So I had a big project come up. I was asked to shoot, and I was on the DP track. That was my goal, is to be a director of photography. And so one of my fellow classmates had a big project, a sci-fi project he wanted to shoot, and he had fired the last, so that was the, that was what was told to me. He had fired the last DP, and he was asking me to shoot. And I ended up saying yes. It was a great experience to a certain point. And then I found that we were just butting heads. It was mostly based on time. He wanted to get his film in the can, is how they say it in that industry. He wanted to get it in the can, and I was interested in putting my signature on this film. And so I was probably taking a little more time than was allotted. And so I just remember getting a call from him one day that they had already taken the film to Telecine and did their transfer, and that there were some exposure issues on some of the shots, and I guess there was a light leak in one of the magazines, which we didn't test. And so I took it really hard. I to this day, I haven't seen the film, but I know it's some of the best work I've done. I just know. And so that, basically at that point, I felt super exposed. I felt like, gosh, who's going to want to work with me after this? That's my reputation. That's it. You know, it's done. And so, so I shifted gears, and I basically ran from that field into the field I'm in now. And, I won't get into the specifics of that career choice. I just remember that was like a major traumatic experience in my life up to that point. And so I remember, I'm still in film school, and I see this documentary. Most of the teachers that taught there, all of the teachers that taught there were working filmmakers in the industry in some capacity. And so one was a documentary filmmaker, and she showed us her documentary on cats. And in this documentary, you learn that they show these cats cruising around a farm, and there's these mice roaming around, and they explain the premise that if a cat is not taught to hunt by its parents, it'll lose that instinct for life. And sure enough, there they were on film showing these cats that had mice, you know, just crawling all around it, and it could care less. And so that's how I felt. I felt like, gosh, I'm damaged goods, and there's little hope to recover. But I will say, there was a second documentary that I saw, And it kind of, it gave me a different perspective on that first documentary. And the second one was about a bird. And the bird was kind of a stocky type of bird hanging out on the shore. And it would, it had the long beak, the long legs, and it would actually wade in the water and it would wait for a fish. And if it were to see a fish, it would pick it off with its beak. And there were no fish coming around. So the fish was not eating. There were two children playing on an opposite shore. And they were dropping breadcrumbs into the water. And the fish were coming up and eating the breadcrumbs. So this bird went and grabbed a breadcrumb, went back to his shore, his or her shore, dropped it in the water and waited. When a fish came up to get it, it caught the fish. And I thought, yes, there's hope. There's hope. And so that's kind of what Al-Anon has been for me. That's what it's done for me. I mean, we come here broken. We come here, some of us crawling in, and I'm certainly no exception. And we find hope. We find hope here. And amazing things happen. Amazing transformations happen. And so so I wanted to talk about some other areas of my life. So So as I was that young kid, high school, after high school, going through college, pursuing these different careers, jumping through all the hoops, studying, I was burning the midnight oil. I was burning the candle at both ends. I was doing everything possible to achieve what it is I was setting my sights on. But I think what I was also doing was trying to not feel. I think I was trying to not feel, numbing out. And one way I saw myself doing that was when I was in training for my current career, I found myself getting to sleep, not planning this consciously, but getting to sleep, or I should say getting only a few hours sleep the night before and going in sleep deprived and functioning like that. And all I can say is that's, not a healthy thing to do. I don't recommend it. I still find myself at times kind of reverting back to that when I find myself in a stressful situation, but numbing out, I guess. And so I went through life very, very lonely, very isolated, too afraid to approach any woman I might be interested in for a relationship, for fear of rejection. And so the relationships I would find myself in were superficial and unfulfilling. And I felt like that bird in the birdcage with the door to the cage is open, but the bird doesn't fly out. That's exactly how I felt. I felt like I was in my own prison. I knew that I was doing this to myself, but I did not know how to get out of the cage. So along comes my girlfriend at the time, Alicia, And so I started dating, and so suddenly I wasn't lonely like I was. And but that's not to say that there were not challenges in the relationship. There was plenty of bumps in the road along the way. We still have bumps. But we started dating. Eventually, we got engaged. And I just knew it wasn't going to work out. And it was because of her, of course. Every reason I had was something she was doing or not doing. And it was clear to me, it's clear as day, that she was the reason why we wouldn't get married. It wasn't going to work out. And so I don't know how long I had my sponsor by that point, but Willie's my sponsor. And I got to say, what a loving man, you know. Willie taught me about trust and loving others. And so when I was going through this with Alicia, I would call Willie and we would talk, and he would just simply say, Pat, you need to take off your running shoes. And that resonated with me because I was a runner, and that's what I would do when I would get stressed out or I was in resentment. I would go for a run, do my 3 miles. And so I thought, okay, if all I have to do is just keep talking to Willie on a daily basis and he would be there, we would work through this together, do the journal, put pen to paper, and write about my feelings that were coming up. I could do this. And I want to say I had my first spiritual awakening. We had an apartment in Downey. I actually moved in with her, and she doesn't know how that happened, but I remember some of my complaints and I'll just say it. Some of my complaints were, I wanted a wife who cooked and she didn't cook. And so I guess that was one of my reasons. So anyways, on the day I had the spiritual awakening, I realized in that moment that I had been projecting my mother onto Alicia and onto the relationship, and that that it wasn't her at all. She wasn't the reason why we weren't going to get married. She wasn't the reason why things were coming to a halt. It was all me. It was a fear of commitment, yes, but the other side of that, going just a little bit deeper, the other side of the coin, it was a fear of abandonment. And so once I saw that in that moment, the weight physically left my body. The weight left my shoulders and rose up. And in that moment, I was able to set a wedding date. So we got married. And we've been married over 13 years. Our marriage is not perfect. There's many challenges. And many times my thinking has gone to the D word, the big D word. And it's I have to say, there's times where I feel like, gosh, is there someone more compatible for me out there? because there's times where we just don't see the eye, we don't see eye to eye on things. And then I guess there's that saying, the grass is always greener. So, and I've gone through these different stages of this where I doubt the strength of our marriage and our compatibility. And it, you know, it just starts sounding an awful lot like how we started, fear of commitment, fear of abandonment. And so each time I've been able to do the work, run the problem through the steps and look at it with a different pair of glasses, that glasses that, if I can say so, Chuck C talks about new pair of glasses. And, that would not be possible without this program. It wouldn't be possible without, my sponsor's help and a higher power who I found in this program, a loving God that wants me to be happy and wants the best for me. And so, gosh, I'm kind of losing my spot here. But I will say that, getting back to doing the work in my marriage, it's work. It really is. But like I've seen throughout the years, whenever I put the time into something and I face the fear and I walk through it with you guys, with Willie, with my higher power, there's always a reward for me waiting on the other side. And I have to say, that the intimacy in our marriage is improving on a daily basis. And, when we clean up our side of the street, the other side cleans up as well. That's, I've heard that in these rooms. And so that's at the core of the work I'm doing right now. And I see the change. I see the change happening on her side. We learn in step one that we're powerless. You know, in Al-Anon, we say we're powerless over people, places, and things. And although I may be powerless over what people choose to say, think, and do, I do have some influence over others through my actions and my thoughts and my words. And that's been pretty powerful. So, I also wanted to touch on, so when I was early on in program and working through some of this stuff with Alicia, I went to this retreat. And if you haven't been to an Al-Anon retreat, I highly recommend it. It's just amazing, amazing experience. And so I went to this retreat in Santa Barbara, and I was with Betty Ann and some of the other gals that ran it, Al-Anon. And they would say, trust the process. Trust the process. And so I thought, okay, I can do that. I can trust the process. But what exactly does that mean? You know, so for me personally, what I found is part of that process was a grief process. And I found, I didn't know what was going on, but I was certainly feeling the feelings, the, you know, everything, including depression, anxiety. And I was grieving, it turned out. I was grieving the relationship with the, you know, the family that I never had. So I want to talk about some amends, and I'm getting close to the end of my time. If you trust the process, the miracles will happen, but don't leave before the miracles happen. Don't leave before the miracle happens. I could have left my marriage many times. I could have walked out. I could have never got married in the first place. But because I've been willing to trust the process and keep my higher power and my sponsor close and get to the meetings and do everything I'm supposed to do, read the literature on a daily basis. My favorite daily reader, Hofer Today. But if I'm able to do those things, it's simple, but it's not easy. And I will say that my life has been transformed. I haven't been through all of my amends, but I've actually been through the main amends. And the thing with amends is if you're not working the steps, you'll continue to repeat, right? Recover or repeat. And so if you're not doing that fourth step and then working it out through your fifth step, sixth step and seventh step, then you will continue to repeat. And back in 2003, I was notified at work that my dad was in the hospital. He had a heart attack, but in addition to that, he was diagnosed with cancer. He had lung cancer and he had 5 months to live. So during that time, this is a man that I lived with I remember not talking. We didn't talk to each other for over a period of 2 years living in the same house. And it was just very severe resentment. And I got to be of service to him. I got to show up, suit up, show up. And just like I've seen you guys do. And I got to be of service to him in his last days. And I got to do an emergency amends because I wasn't on that step, right? And in my amends that I wrote down and read to my dad, I just got to say, you know, Dad, I'm sorry that I didn't show more of an interest in your life and that I didn't share more of my life with you. That was it. And in those 5 months, I got to meet the man under the disease. And I got to have a new relationship that I never thought was possible. And when my dad passed, when he had passed, again, I found myself bottling those emotions, and bottling grief is not something you should do. And it was causing all kinds of symptoms. And so I was at a meeting, struggling through a meeting, which I don't know if you guys have experienced that, but you know, anyways, I finally got to release that. I finally found forgiveness by looking at how much I was struggling with my own character defects and realizing that if I wasn't perfect, how could I expect my dad to be perfect? And that and attending open AA meetings just really opened my heart. also got to make my amends to my mother. And the main thing that I said to her was, Mom, how I've had a really bad attitude towards you all of these years. I think that's called a resentment. And I'm so sorry. Today I get to be a service and show up for my mom, who's 94 now. And she's got onset dementia, and thank God she's got the care that she needs. And the one resentment the one they tell you to write down that you'll never make, but just go ahead and write it down anyways. That was my brother. And this happened not too long ago. It just happened to be the right timing. We were alone at the house, and I'm skipping over a big part where basically he took ownership of the house, my parents' house, and it was a covert transaction. And I found out about it later. And so a few months back, I got to tell my brother that how I felt about that, that at the time I was angry, but that I forgive him, that I don't want anything from him. I just want, if possible, I just want a relationship if he's willing. And so I've yet to see that transpire. So I knocked out all the hard ones, and I've got quite a few more to make. And as long as I don't keep adding to the list, you know, and that I learned to live my life in a way that I could feel good about every day by making a living amends where possible, or a direct amends where possible. So
8:25.
Thank you, sir. So I am going to wrap it up by saying, the only way I see that's possible, that I'm still here with you guys, that I'm on this earth, is because of this program and because of a higher power that I got to know in this program. Before Al-Anon, it was a punishing God that I had, and I had to ditch that God, and I had to find a loving God who's willing to care for me. All I have to do is let him. All I have to do is make a decision. And life's good. Thank you for letting me share.